This is CliffCentral.com.
It is a Thursday morning on CliffCentral.com, and a live interview in a moment or two with one of South Africa's greatest, Mongeningema. We'll talk to him in a second. It's been something that's been long in the making here, and there are several thousand reasons why I've always wanted to have Mongeningema around. But this morning we've got plenty to talk about: new projects, old projects, a bit of a retrospective, the things that he's most proud of, this incredible career, awards that he's received just recently. He's here with us. Mongeningema, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
It's so nice to see you.
Very pleased to be here.
First of all, congrats on the Sama over the weekend.
Thank you so much.
That's just another accolade in your crown. Another jewel in the crown. I'm very, very pleased that that people are starting to, you know, these sort of lifetime achievement things, do they make you feel like, because a lot of people go, oh, well, my life's not finished yet. I've still got more going on. Do they make you feel that people are almost, you know, sort of ushering you out on your way through? Or is it an honor that you take as it's given by people who respect and admire?
Absolutely. I take it as an honor that's given, you know, because one has done so much body of work. Mm. And when do you begin to say thank you to a person? You don't want to wait for a person to pass on to the next life. So hopefully I'll get another one in a few years to come.
Let's start off with the stuff you're doing right now, and then we can go back in time and look at some of the things that have changed people's lives and had such an effect on the culture of South Africa. But you're busy with something now called Woza Albert.
Yes. Woza Albert is one of my oldest classics. In fact, the oldest. It's the production that launched me into the international market with Pearson Twa and Barney Simon way back in 1981. And won every award in the world that it was eligible for, and was regarded as the South African classic ever to come at that time. And it's back. It's a set work in
this
schools.
This is a revival now.
It's a revival.
Yeah.
It's a set work in schools, and these young people keep wanting to do Woza Albert. It's evergreen, and I'm always honored to say, yes, please go ahead and do it. It's at the Joburg Theatre now. It opened last week, and it will perform there until the 17th of June.
It must make you very pleased that something can stand the test of time, that it has longevity like this, and that it has application for an audience that's changed. I mean, for young people to be as attracted to this material as the people who you wrote it for in the 1980s. That's
amazing.
That's tremendous.
It's tremendous, because, well, first of all, we were just at that time doing a social commentary based on what we were seeing in the streets. And we never knew that it would, 40 years later, be as relevant as it was then in 1981. But it seems to me that we go forward only to go backwards again.
Well, I suppose also you can't ignore something that's that good, that speaks to so many people
but
on that level.
But the creativity in that production, I mean, it's amazing. I think what makes it stand the test of time is the artistry. It's not just the social or political comment, but it is how it was written and how it was staged.
Well, also, to maintain a relevance is a very difficult thing to do, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's, because the circumstances change, people's priorities change, the social fabric in this country has certainly changed an enormous amount since the 1980s. So what is it you think about these stories that you're telling through music and through performance? What do you think it is about them that makes them so universal and so relevant for such a long period?
I think it gets right to the core of humanity. You know, I remember in California, many years ago, I saw a production, what was it called? It was by a young woman. I nearly said Annie was a musical. It was based on the Holocaust, on this woman who was sitting alone in the basement during Hitler's Holocaust. The name has just skipped me.
Anne Frank?
Anne Frank. Oh, Diary, yes, of,
yes,
Anne Frank.
Anne Frank.
Diary of Anne Frank.
Diary of Anne Frank.
To this day, I saw that production in the 80s, but it is still so present in my memory to this day, such that it was a situation that happened so many miles away from South Africa, but I think I would love to produce it in South Africa.
I think that probably you've hit the nail on the head here. It's like there's a common humanity, there's a story that we can all relate to. And that story doesn't matter from a historical point of view whether it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
It touches you in a way that you're drawn in. You can imagine yourself in that experience.
Absolutely. And I think it is those kinds of productions that will live on forever.
Well, speaking of productions that live on forever, I mean, you must look back on Sarafina now and just be blown away by how that turned into this juggernaut.
Of course. I mean, how did I know that this thing would just kept on catapulting? I mean, right now we are at the Joburg Theatre preparing for yet another opening of Sarafina on the 14th of this month, June, to celebrate the Youth Month. Sarafina is back at the Joburg Theatre at the Mandela Theatre, running until the 24th of December of June, and then from there we're going to Martinique in the Caribbean Islands.
Oh, nice, that's a nice place to go and spend some time.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Always summer.
I imagine that you're not unhappy about that trip you have to take.
Not at all.
No.
Especially coming from this cold Johannesburg at the moment.
I just want to mention for people who don't already know, because this is incredible. Sarafina was nominated for 5 Tony Awards. It was later nominated for the Grammys. It won 11 NAACP Awards in a 2-year run on Broadway, toured the US, Europe, Australia, Japan, and was later adapted into a feature film which starred Whoopi Goldberg, Lelete Khumalo, and Miriam Makeba. And of course, the musical soundtrack, with the movie and the soundtrack produced alongside Quincy Jones, that must have been an incredible experience. Yeah, Quincy Jones wrote this, he's written a number of stories, but he's actually written his first authorized biography just recently, and the stories in there are just unbelievable. That man,
he's an unbelievable guy, man. Unbelievable. I mean, I remember way back when we first met, I was doing Asina Mali in Harlem, and a friend of mine, Cindy Kaplan, had met him in Miami on the beach, and she said, ran to him and said, "Quincy, you have to meet this incredible young man from South Africa, Mbongeni Ngema. He's doing a production in Harlem." And a few days later, I park on with an open van, a Jeep, on 57th Street in New York. Quincy comes out of the hotel. He shakes my hand and he hops into the Jeep, and off we were to Harlem. I mean, wow. When we arrived in that small theater in Harlem, there was a guy drunk, sleeping next to the door. And he turns around and he says, "Hey, you look like Quincy Jones."
That well-known, huh? Even the bums knew he was like the mayor of Harlem.
and from there on, we started an incredible journey, a relationship that would, he would literally just, his office looked after Asina Mali when he toured the U.S. for 5 years. And then Sarafina. I mean, Quincy brought everybody to see Sarafina. Michael Jackson, the Jackson family, whoever you can think of, Danny Glover, and every week Quincy would be bringing another person. You have to see this production on Broadway.
He has done as much for music and for theater, I suppose, and a lot of other performing arts than just about anyone in the world when it comes to the contribution he's made and the people he's introduced to each other, the kinds of collaborations that he's done. In some ways, I think almost like you're our Quincy Jones, you know? You've put people together. You've created these shows. You've composed and written and orchestrated so much of our own cultural tapestry.
Yes, I guess he inspired me a great deal when I was growing up as a young kid. I remember that old song, how good is a song? And I used to listen to those arrangements and say, damn, man, this guy can really arrange music. And he inspired me. And I think that between Gibson Kente, who mm-hmm. was our South African genius, and Quincy Jones, those two people in my life became a pillar of strength.
Now, the interesting thing about all of this is that there are, we mentioned earlier, young and old people who feel drawn to it. Is it very difficult for you to see so many interpretations, not from the point of view that you're precious about it, but when you see your work going far and wide, and a Japanese audience somehow understands these stories, is it difficult for you to comprehend that scale of success? I mean, I'd imagine that it's not about the money you make. It's not about the people you meet. It's almost this transcendent idea of, this is my contribution. This will outlive me for many decades and centuries. And that must be a very scary thing to confront.
True, very true, Cliff. You know, I never thought that my work would be... I knew I wanted to be successful. From the beginning, I wanted to be successful. But I never, ever comprehended that it would turn out to be... To almost rub to... Most people in the world, I mean, this week in New York, there was a great article. My movie, Asina Mali, was showing in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, screening there. And the review that came out of that, the writer said it resonated so well as it was on stage in the mid-80s when they saw it on film. And it goes on, and we're going to be releasing Asina Mali on screen in South Africa in August on all the Stereokinetic cinemas. So what I'm trying to say, it just never stops. It keeps, like, the sea waves, it keeps rolling back. But the greatest joy, as you said, is not about the money. Because how many meals can you eat in a day if you have money? But it is how much you have impacted on individuals around the world. As you say, the Japanese, the Australians, in the remotest corners of the world, you hear a person singing, "Freedom is coming tomorrow," and you say, wow, what was happening when I wrote that song?
But I mean, it's also a business success. I mean, you have had what you said earlier, you wanted to be successful. If you weren't in music, if you weren't in production like you are, if you weren't in the career that you're in, you probably would have been successful in other things. Was there ever a backup plan? Did you want to be, you know, an athlete? Did you want to be a businessman in a more traditional financial sense? What was the backup plan for Mbongeni Ngema all those years ago?
Unfortunately, I never had a backup plan, because when I was from 11 years of age, I was already playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was just going to be a good musician, because I love music. So I thought, well, I used to listen to the Beatles during those days of A Hard Day's Night and A Ticket to Ride. And those guys sounded harmonies. I mean, they sounded so beautiful. And that's where my heart was. And as time went on, I was introduced to theater. And I said, wow, that's also interesting. I can mix the music and the acting. Then introduced to movies. So it kept on just getting bigger and bigger.
Do you feel that it's important to have an understanding of music across genres? A lot of people,
absolutely.
A lot of people like to listen to a certain kind of music, and I feel like sometimes they're missing out on the ability to hear a variety of things. I still have to develop, I don't think I'm sophisticated enough to develop the appreciation of jazz, because I think that also comes later in life when you have a more sophisticated palate for these things. But I do love all kinds of, a great song is a great song no matter what genre it comes from, right?
Yeah. Yes. I was lucky that I grew up in a musical family, so my taste spanned from jazz to gospel to, as I say, to pop, rock and roll, to mbakanga, to everything. So in a way, it helped me, because when I started writing my music, I could go anywhere with my music. If I wanted to go the song to sound a little like pop, or sound like, you know, I mean, I enjoy Freddie Hubbard. I used to enjoy his music so much, in as much as I would enjoy Josh Benson.
Right.
Yeah.
You're also a proud Zulu man, and you're proud of that heritage, and it informs the way that you have created some of the stuff that's where you come from. It's part of, you know, who you are. Do you sometimes think that is a uniqueness that helped you in your career? That, you know, if you were just another American, it might have been a lot harder to make the impact that you made.
I think so. Not only if I was just another American, if I was just another township boy, you know. When I was young, it was during the time of forced removals. So my family was removed from the city to the township when they established Kwamashu Township in Durban. Mm. So my father, instead of going to Kwamashu because he didn't want me to grow there, he moved me to...
Because that was a very tough township.
Yes.
I mean, the townships and the townships, but Kwamashu is one
very
of the
tough.
Yeah.
My father decided to take me to Zululand, to rural Zululand, and I hated that because here I was coming from the city, being moved as a young man to start a new life, to herd cattle, to be a head boy, to do stick fighting, to do all those things. And then later on in life, I came back to the townships. But when I look back, my vocabulary in music, in theater, in everything, I have such a deeper vocabulary than a boy who just grew up in Soweto. Because I can go back and think of the harmonies of rural Zululand in as much as I can think about the harmonies of Soweto. So it just broadened my scope as an artist.
And that cultural heritage is something which I think allows other people who might not have had that experience of living in it and being part of it, people who want to connect with it, can do that through your music.
Absolutely. You know, I find that because I also lived in the hostels, because life was rough during apartheid, I can relate to a guy in a hostel and also to a guy who's streetwise, who's in Sandton. So I tend to talk to everybody with my music and my theater. And for me, what was such a doomed life in the beginning turned out to be a means of becoming successful.
And I suppose also this is why you ended up lecturing too, because while it's great to do all the things that you've done, I suppose there's a part of everybody where they want to give back and where other people want to tap not just your musical mind, but your thoughts on the surrounding stories, the inspirations, the impact, those kinds of things. And then lecturing, which you did at university, was probably a part of that, giving back, that interaction.
Yes, of giving back, of making, you see, especially lecturing in music and in theater, because in most cases you find students studying theater, but the theater that they're studying is away from their cultural roots.
Right.
And when they walk out of university, they have a degree, but when you put them, and you know this because you've auditioned people, you put them on the stage and you audition them, you find nothing there because they cannot connect with their cultural roots.
Mm.
Whereas...
Themselves.
With themselves. Whereas because I have lived through the university of life, that's where I was lectured myself, I can tell a person to look deep into where they come from and who they are and form a character that they're trying to portray.
You've been given lots of accolades and honors over the years, and I mean, we talk about the Walk of Fame in New York, we talk about these awards, the various shows, the big awards, the ones that maybe we think of as slightly lesser, but all of them are
very important.
Do you keep them somewhere?
I do. I have, not all of them. Some of them I have lost because, as artists, we are nomadic people.
Someone will discover a box one day.
Someone will discover a box one day. But I do keep some of them. Hollywood, the Tonys.
Yes.
If
I go to your house, they're there.
You'll find something.
Okay.
Certainly you'll find a few Summers and other awards at home.
Do you think that matters? Because for a lot of people, the award is, it's praise and it's honor and it's great and all of those things, but it's more important almost when you meet someone whose life has been changed by a song, by a performance, by watching a play, whose story feels, they feel that their story's been told by your characters.
It's important. I think these awards. Also, they are an inspiration to the young and up-and-coming artists.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a person who's collected all these awards, as a young person, you say you aspire to that. You want to reach greater heights as an artist. I think they are important in inspiring the youth.
Before we move on from your Zulu heritage, I mean, I'm quite interested in your ancestry. I'm quite interested in the Ngema clan and kind of what you know about your own personal history and how that that adds value and adds substance and gravity to what you write. Can you tell us a little bit about who you descend from?
Well, I'm a descendant of the, as you said, the great Ngema clan. My great-grandfather actually was one of the warriors, the commanders that fought at the Battle of Isandlwana in 1879 during the Anglo-Zulu War.
Right.
And that is the story that I was told over and over and over as a young boy.
It was probably one of the few, you can maybe count them on one hand, occasions where the British lost.
Yes.
And they didn't expect to lose.
It was the greatest defeat for the crown in the colonies. And they had never been defeated anywhere in Africa. They had just defeated Napoleon in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And here, and then they come to Southern Africa and they meet with the Zulu army. Hands down, they were defeated. Only 5 men survived in that battle. They met with 30,000 Zulu warriors, and my great-grandfather was one of the commanders in that battle. And that history...
What was his name?
His name was...
Is it Bandama?
Bandama, which means ringworm in English, loosely translated.
That's not a great nickname. So he was one of the people who commanded that, because you could still go to Sandrana now and you could see the battlefield, and
yes,
there are people who can explain how it all happened. I mean, this is a fascinating part of South African history. Very few people pay attention.
In fact, some of the names of the people that fought there in one of the hotels there on the mountain are inscripted on the door of each room. Well, not all of them, because out of 30,000 warriors and so many commanders, you can only take a few. But he was alongside his brother Gcwele Kamhlekehleke, who was a senior commander in that battle. And so that's the story that was told all the time. This was during the time of King Cetshwayo. And of course, the second battle of Ulundi, that's when the Zulus were defeated by the British finally. And King Cetshwayo was taken into incarceration at Oude Molen in Cape Town before 2 years later he asked to see the Queen in England. And in fact, that then began the destruction of the greatest Zulu empire, the only empire at the time that was standing in Southern Africa.
That's right.
Or perhaps in the entire African continent.
So you come from a line of warriors. Are you fighting with anyone at the moment?
Well, I fight through my art. And I was lucky because I grew up with my great-grandmother, who was a little girl who almost saw the beginning of the Zulu Empire. Because think about it.
Wow.
When
she was there at the time of Sazangakhona and Shaka, or
no, after
so Dingaan.
Her father
Mpande.
Her father was in Dingaan's army.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, her father was in Dingaan's army. He was in a regiment called Mkulutjana, so hence her name was, she was called Oga Mkulutjana, which means the one belonging to Mkulutjana.
What sort of stories did she tell you as a child?
Well, she would tell me how, what it felt like when they first saw white people arrive in Zululand. You know, the missionaries, when they came on horseback, they had never seen horses before. And they didn't know what was happening, these people with the different color who were, and the missionaries, I must say, to their credit at the time, they had learned somewhere, before they got into deep Zululand, they had learned the Zulu language, so they could communicate with the old people. And she would tell me, she would show me her dress. I mean, I was, what, nine years of age. And she would show me her dress because a lot of the Zulu people during that time were only wearing skins when I grew up. And she would show me her dress and tell me this is Jalimane, which means a German dress. Her dress had been brought in by the missionaries who came from Germany. And that was the only dress that she wore. It was old at the time, and it had also even developed lice. And she was blind, of course, during that time, as she was telling me all these stories. I mean, I don't
know. How old did she, get? How long did she live?
Well, she was as old as history. I mean, she was born in the 1800s, and this was around 1958, 1959, when she was telling me these stories. So,
I mean, it must be incredible to have first-hand history like that. You know, we often imagine history to be, and I think a lot of people who are growing up now think of it as something in books. But when it's told as stories like that, it's much more powerful.
But what was even much more fascinating for me was that it was, thinking about it now, it was as though she was saying to me, "My boy, never forget who your great ancestors were. They were Mbandama, they were Skwele Kwele, and they fought in these battles, and they walked here."
It's pride.
The pride.
It gives you a background. Someone once said to me, if you have a background, then it's easy to start building your foreground.
Yes, and when I
like
started...
Like a set in a
play. Yes, and when I started getting into theater, telling stories, it suddenly dawned on me that this is what she was implanting on me, because she was a great storyteller. Without fail, in the evenings when I was in Zululand, she would call me to her hut, which was filled with smoke from the fires. Yeah. And she would begin to tell these stories.
Eyes were burning.
Eyes were burning, and she, with her little box of snuff.
Yeah.
And she would begin to tell these stories, and I didn't know. I mean, as a young, that young, you don't know why this old woman is telling you all these things.
But you listened.
Because
if you hadn't listened, you wouldn't have been able to tell the stories you tell.
Fortunately, I did listen.
That's a rare thing. I think a lot of kids missed out on that with their grandparents and their great-grandparents.
Yes. And then later on in life, other people like my grandfather and then my father would tell stories. But when I began to read, very interestingly, when I began to be interested in history, and I began to read South African history, in particular the history about the Zulu people, I could then begin to trace back what she was telling me. Oh, this is what she was talking about. Oh, the Battle of Isandlwana, this is what happened from the Zulu perspective, and now from the British perspective. I could knit the two together, and yeah, it was an exciting. It's been, for me, that is more than anything I've done, that is the best thing that ever happened to my life.
That's incredible. Isn't it great, though, that your stories, that the things that you're contributing to our culture, will be preserved in a way that hers never could? If you didn't have a good memory, for example, if you couldn't remember what she told you, they'd be lost forever.
Absolutely.
And now, in a world of technology, in a world where there are reliable ways to record things and inform people about how things work, I mean, obviously there's still a lot of nonsense and fakeness out there, but it is special that these stories of yours will be preserved, that they're preserved in music, that they're preserved in performance, on film.
Very importantly. I mean, we are lucky that we are living in an age where there's this technology available. I think back, you know, I had two brothers that were older than me. And I wondered why I was the only one who was singled out to be told these stories to. And sometimes they would look at me as a peculiar person when I started relating the stories to them older than me. They would sort of remember our great-grandmother talking to me, but they didn't bother to know what she was saying to me. And I don't know why she always, without fail, would call my name and bring me to her heart.
She knew. She must have known.
Somehow. I mean, old people had intuition before there was technology.
That's right. What is for you the most exciting part of being around now and being able to see the fruits of your labors and to be able to see that the impact that this has on people. What's the best and what's the most difficult part of all of that?
Well, the most difficult part of it is that when I walk around or drive around in the cities or the townships, all the young people come to me and they expect that I can help all of them. And it is not humanly possible.
Yeah.
You can only be able to impact on a few people. I mean, look at people like Somizi, who I'm so proud of, who I used to chase away from the rehearsal room because he was so young.
And he was two, three, 4 years old, huh?
Yes, and I kept saying to him, go to school. And he would find a way of dodging me, coming back, and before I knew it, he was there. And finally, I had to give in and put him in Sarafina some years later and look at where he is today.
It's tremendous.
Tremendous. But South Africa is exciting. We are a new country. There are so many greater possibilities now. I was talking before I walked into the studio here. I said, you know, when in the early 80s, I went to the United States, I was baffled because I saw these small independent radio stations. I mean, I came from South Africa where if someone says you're going to be interviewed on radio or on TV, you'd go to that gigantic building at the SABC.
Yeah.
You know, and there I was in the U.S. and I saw these little radio stations that were so powerful that impacted on people. And for me, that was culture shock, and it's happening now in South Africa.
Well, you've still got many stories to tell, and one of the things that I know you're interested in doing, I don't know how far you've gone down this road, but doing a musical based on the life and times of Nelson Mandela.
That's my latest, biggest project that I'm embarking on now.
It's mammoth.
It's mammoth. I mean, where and how do you begin to tell the story of this man, the world, the greatest statesman ever, I think, for me, ever to walk the soil of the earth.
And you knew him and you met him many times. I'm sure you get annoyed when you hear people who didn't meet him and didn't know him talking about how he didn't do enough or he didn't do this or he didn't do that.
Can you imagine one human being responsible for everyone's life?
No.
For 50 million people's
Incredible.
Life. I mean, this man, he had broad shoulders. And no matter how difficult the situation is, I mean, I remember his smile. He would always be smiling and thoughtful and always welcoming. I mean, I remember I brought so many people to meet with him, and each time he would say, "Bongeni is our icon." When all of us were like taking off our hats and saying, "This is our icon," he would turn around and say, "Bongeni." I remember I brought Muhammad Ali to meet him in Orlando, and people like Kenneth Gamble, who produced all those songs for the OJs, and Tandy Pendergrass.
Oh, wow.
What a great man. Great, great guy. But yes, I'm doing this musical, and I call it Nelson Mandela Through the Eyes of an Artist, because I want to portray him the way I saw him and the way I understood him. I just don't want to do a documentary of Nelson Mandela. People have done that before. Many movies have come out, including Long Walk to Freedom, which I think are just documentaries of Nelson Mandela. But how would an artist, if I was a painter, how would I paint a series of scenes about Nelson Mandela? Or if Nelson Mandela could play a piano, what would he say to the people of South Africa?
How do your songs come to you? I mean, how do you compose? What's your method?
Usually they come at night when I'm sleeping.
Do you have something to write down on, or do you have something to record? Do you wake up in the night? Because you don't want to wake up and have forgotten them.
No. Fortunately, at home, I have a piano. When a song comes, I wake up and go straight to the piano.
In your room?
In the living room. Yeah.
So you then have to get dressed now in the cold. In the cold of winter, you have to get dressed up and go downstairs and sit at the piano.
I go to the piano, dressed or undressed.
Okay.
And I sit
there. It's your house. You can do what you want.
Yes. But when I'm not at home. I remember at one time I was in London, prepared in a hotel. Mm-hmm. The next day I was going to be flying to South Africa, way back in the 80s. At that time I was preparing another musical, Township Fever, and this great song came to my mind. And I thought, wow, I don't have a recorder with me. What do I do? So I took a pen and paper in the hotel. I started writing notes down. By the time I landed in South Africa, fortunately, it was there on paper. I couldn't forget it.
Thank goodness, because you must have had occasions where you forgot like a little melody or something and you were annoyed with yourself.
Yes, you get annoyed. I mean, you have this great song, but if you can't have means of recording it, you get so annoyed because you will forget it, especially if it comes at night.
How much of you do you pour into all of this? Because it can be very taxing on a person to share that much of themselves and such intimate stuff. You know, when you're a songwriter, when you're allowing people into your world, it can be very taxing. It can be very tiring.
It is, but you know, you enjoy it. You cannot half give yourself in. You completely, for me, I say, you know, when I write a song or when I step into a rehearsal room, is for me, that's my church. I give myself completely to the moment. And by the time we finish there, I think I've said praise to my God. That's, for me, it's, if I can describe it that way, it's the best way I can say thank you to God for all the talent you gave me.
And the number of people, you mentioned Somizi earlier, the number of people you've given an opportunity to, actors, actresses, singers, musicians, are there people there that you're particularly proud of? Are there people there whose contribution after the fact, and probably only made possible by your initial contact with them, has made you feel really good?
Absolutely. I mean, Somizi being one of them, Leleti being another one.
Leleti Khumalo, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lebo M.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, that Lion King thing that you guys did, and you were part of that process as well. Look what that became.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Lebo, he used to come to me when we had cassettes. He was living in Los Angeles. He was in exile. He went to exile when I was very young. And he used to come to me and say, listen to this song, listen on cassette. And look at where he is today.
Sure.
I mean, I then later on put him on Sarafina, and that was a life changer for him. And many other people, including Americans that are not South Africans, that Gina, Lawrence Fishburne's wife, I took her in, and she's one of the biggest stars in America today.
Are there lots of people in America that you're in constant communication with? You know, sometimes the distance and sometimes the passage of time makes people drift apart, but there must be friends of yours in America. You mentioned Quincy, you know, Teddy Pendergrass, these people who, obviously some of them are alive, some of them are not with us anymore. But,
yes, but
these must be friendships that you cherish.
Absolutely. I mean, one of them who I'm in constant communication with is, who I know when I leave a message, he'll return my call, is Kenneth Gamble.
Oh, nice.
Without
How many
fail.
People can say he's just a friend you can speed dial? Sure.
You know,
do you speak on the phone?
We speak on the phone. And whenever, I mean, he lives in Philadelphia, but when I come, because I'm mostly in New York when I'm in the States, when I get to New York, I know that Kenny Gamble will be coming to New York from Philly.
Sure.
And my old manager, he was my manager, and Kool and the Gang's manager, Voza Rivers, we're still close friends to this day.
What a life. What a life. What stories. What incredible contributions you've made. I'm really, really pleased to see you. And honestly, the things that you've done and the amount of a difference you've made to South Africa being seen as an international competitor and an international contributor to art, to culture, to music. I mean, we can't thank you enough. You've put us on the map in some ways.
No, thank you so much. In maybe, I don't know how, I mustn't be the one who says in parting, but I'm on the Mandela musical. I'm working on this one great song, an All Africa Star song, with people like Salif Keita, people like Angelique Kidjo, wow. Kay Janine. Yesterday I was talking to Jonathan Butler. We want to do a salute song to Madiba as all African artists, like Quincy did with We Are the World.
Yes.
So that's what I'm going to be producing.
That sounds spectacular. We look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mbogeni Ngema, everybody. It is a very, very special Thursday morning. And make sure that you go along and see Waza Albert while it's still on, because he's now he's brought it out from... He's dusted it off and he's put it back on the stage for you, and it's as good as ever. And you need to go and see it ASAP. So, in case you want the details, Waza Albert is happening at the Joburg Theatre. It's showing from the 1st of June until the 17th of June, so you've still got about 10 days to get in there and go and see it. And, of course, the great Mbogeni Ngema. Thank you so much, sir. Pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
And thanks for talking history with me. I find one in every 1,000 people who wants to talk history with me. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What is the best way to get the most out of your email marketing? Well, Touchbase Pro has become the most cost-effective way and the most advanced to know more about your customers and allows you to speak to them when it matters. Here at Cliff Central, we experience this firsthand because we use them for our email marketing. At Touchbase Pro, you can get your dedicated account manager who will turn indifferent customers into customers who can't wait to talk to you. They'll do this by collecting meaningful insights and valuable info on what interests your users so that you can target individuals and create new strategies. Plus, they will help you with setting up lead nurturing email campaigns to maximize sales and mend the love lost between sales and marketing. So, at the end of each month, you and your account manager will get meaningful reports that will show you and your team all the important information, taking the guesswork out of the email marketing statistics. The first 5 companies to contact them right now on emailwins.co.za will receive a mini strategic assessment and email campaign to 25,000 customers. So do that today. Emailwins.co.za. Just send them a mail right now, emailwins.co.za, and you could end up with that as a great way to start, a great launch for your email campaigns from here on in. With a Touchbase Pro Account Manager, you will get to send emails your customers can't ignore. Go to emailwins.co.za. If you change nothing, nothing changes. All right, we will see you tomorrow.
This is CliffCentral.com.